The following program is presented by the Nerdy Show Podcast Network. Geeky programming for all nerds across the multiverse. All Nerdy Show programming is made possible by A Comic Shop, Orlando's number one comic shop and nerd destination, Nerdapalooza, the world's largest nerd music festival, and with the generous support of listeners like you. For more Nerdy Show podcasts, community forums, and learn how you can support this and other fine Nerdy Show programming, visit nerdyshow.com.
Hey, this is Eric from the Megas.
This is Greg from the Megas.
This is Mikey from the Megas.
This is Josh from the Megas.
And we love
Nerdy Show.
Yeah, we love it. Boosh.
Butterfly in the sky.
Welcome to Nerdy Show Book Club. Nerdy Show is a weekly podcast that talks about everything geeky throughout the multiverse, and Nerdy Show Book Club is our every month or so show all about reading books. That's things without so many pictures in them, just a few. Hi, I'm Cap.
Hi, I'm Hex.
I'm Tony.
I'm Brandon.
And I'm Colin.
And we're here to talk about books, aren't we?
Yes, we are. We are here to talk about, Nerdy Show Book Club. For those of you just tuning in, Nerdy Show Book Club, we have a book that we discuss, well, that we read along with the Nerdy Show community. And then we discuss it on this episode. We also talk about what other books we've been reading.
I love it. This brings up my list of books I've read to three now in total.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. It's great.
I have so many to do to catch up with you. This is my first time here. It's my first book ever.
It's a new hobby.
Brandon is our ticket to government subsidiaries because we are...
I've learned to read via the Nerdy Show.
We're getting some government money from little Brandon here teaching him how to read. So the book of this particular month is Ready Player One. And we have had a tremendous response to us reading this book.
Even though it was Colin's choice.
We had the most response for Old Man's War 2, so suck it, Hex.
Yeah, I guess you're good for something after all.
Mm-hmm.
Where's this going?
It's going nowhere. It's going... I hate you, Colin. Yeah.
Ready Player One's written by a fella named Ernest Klein. He's got a background in the film and television industry. And this is his first book, right?
It's his first novel. Yeah. But before the book was even published, the movie rights were purchased.
Well, okay, so they are making a movie, or they just someone has the
Warner
rights?
Brothers.
The rights have been purchased. So
Warner Brothers owns the rights to Ready Player One.
I would like to see how they use all of the material in that.
Yeah, I'm ready to see the licensing minefield they're about to step into.
Ready Player One is... It's an interesting book for the nerd community because
it's an 80s fanboy's dream.
It is basically made for the nerd community specifically. It requires a lot of knowledge about 80s centric pop culture. And if you don't have that, it might be tough to get into.
So if you're in the nerd community right now, this is essentially what you and your friends have been talking about, just written down in book form.
Basically,
if you're listening to a podcast called Nerdy Show, then you should probably read this book.
Yeah.
Or at the very least, this book, you are the target audience for this book.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whether or not you're going to read it, well, don't take our word for it. So, like I said, we did have a massive response to this in the Nerdy Show forums. You know, when you guys are reading along with us, we love to see what you're thinking. Slew of comments and some people who, in fact, read this book in one sitting.
Can you do that? Can people read a book in one sitting?
It takes me two days to read a
video game manual.
So I just about finished this in one sitting. Like I read one chapter, and then the next night I read two chapters. Then the next night, I did not go to sleep.
I will have to say I read it in about four poop sittings, which was pretty good. That's where I get all my reading done if you haven't listened to the show before. Pooped four times and I was done with the book. I was amazed. I couldn't get off the toilet because I was like, no, I need to eat more food and build up more poop because I really want to read the rest of this book.
Sorrento's back. I need to take a shit.
Basically, I just kept eating while I was on the can so I could keep reading.
Oh, God.
So it's a vicious cycle.
It is, but I enjoyed it.
It's like fucking human centipede.
It makes me like the book better because it's like I'm enjoying the book and something is being released from me. So it's like a double fuck. Yeah.
I believe that's the human shitipede. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Man. What were you eating? That's the big question, though.
And there's your intro. Macaroni and cheese, which you would think would clog you up, but not when you have it with laxative.
Jesus.
He thinks of everything, kids. He thinks of everything.
He does.
When cheese finally comes out with a laxative, shit. Literally.
Craft lax?
Oh, yeah.
Steers this shit in the harbor.
Cap, you were saying that most people actually read it within a week, but the one you were talking about who read it in a day was Cassie Muldrow.
That's nuts. She's awesome. We all read it as fast as we humanly could, probably, because it does hit a point there where you're like, Ernest Cline has a knack for knowing what to end chapters on to make you go, a little bit more, and then you think you're going to stop in that, but you keep going. If there's anything about this book that is truly a triumph, it is the pacing that encourages readers to keep going.
Yeah.
What's interesting about this book, we should probably back up. You'll know that there's sort of a semi-regular cast for Nerdy Show Book Club, and we tend to have a rotating spot. Today we've got Tony in our rotating book club spot.
Hi, everybody.
He is literally rotating.
Whee! He is spinning around. The reason he's here is not just because he read the book, but he also listened to the book.
Yeah, there's an audio version of Ready Player One that's read by Will Wheaton. It tempers the book in a weird way that we'll get into when we get a little bit
more
into the
discussion.
You're saying
I don't have to read? I can just listen to shit?
Oh,
it is important.
We shouldn't have let that
on. Do they have audiobooks of Cliff Notes? So I can just be double fast.
This is bad.
The government
audiobooks are not a real thing.
The government didn't tell me this.
No, you see, I actually hired Will Wheaton to read the book to me.
Oh, I see. Well, he does anything for
money. It was pricey.
It was, but you know, that's my dedication to Nerdy Show. I needed to get on this book club thing that you guys were doing. I was tired of being left out, and Will Wheaton was available.
Will Wheaton.
Going to this book, I had a few concerns.
Was it any good? Obviously.
Right. Well, the thing is that it had been pretty hyped for a while now. And this whole theory of it having this massive, you know, nerd credibility of like, oh, you'll love it. It talks about all the stuff you love. But I mean, you know, we do Nerdy Show because we like talking about this stuff. You guys listen to Nerdy Show because you like talking slash listening to this stuff. You know, we have a functional, natural nerd community. And I worried that this book, this conscious, deliberate message to our group slash sect slash generation of people would be too heavy-handed, really pretentious, and just take it too far and make me feel uncomfortable. And
they'd be exploiting the genre,
essentially
exploiting the audience. Yeah,
yeah. I felt that was a pretty valid concern, and based on some things I'd heard from people, there was something people say a lot, and I don't really understand it, having read the book. Is people call Ready Player One Twilight for nerds?
That doesn't make any sense.
At all.
No, there's nothing even remotely similar about that.
There's no pretty boys.
I
read the first Twilight.
Oh, why would you let anybody know that?
I'm ashamed to admit it.
It's not on a blooper reel. That's sticking in the episode.
I read the first Twilight. Now, the reason why I read the first Twilight is because my wife, who is smarter than I am, and reads infinitely faster than
I do. Keep that up, because she's going to be listening to this. We'll go with it.
Yeah, no, she read the first book, and she was like, you should read it, because she was on the third book by the time I started the first one. And
you said she's smarter than you.
Honestly, with Colin, that's not much of a triumph.
she's gonna hate all of you after this, by the way.
So anyway, regardless, the book, she was reading Twilight, and as she read Twilight, the main thing is that she reads exceptionally fast. Uh-huh. And I believe the reason why people are calling this Twilight for nerds is because it is, you can read it, you get sucked in, and you read it really fast. Now,
I read Ready Player One
really fast, but I did not read Twilight very fast.
Okay, so you didn't get sucked into Twilight.
Did you get sucked off?
There was no sucking going on, despite the vampire.
Oh no, there was sucking going on.
Why not Harry Potter? People get sucked into that shit and read the whole thing as fast as possible.
Harry Potter's good.
I kind of see where they're coming from a little bit, because there are parts of this book, and maybe it came across more in the audiobook than it did in the actual book, where it kind of plays out like this self-indulgent fantasy on behalf of the writer.
Yeah, I had the same problem.
One of the big things that you get into with Twilight is that it reads like this is what Stephanie Meyer wrote when she was 12, and then just got a slightly larger vocabulary, took it to a publisher, and there it ran. And there are parts of this book that really do feel like, this is who I wanted to be as a kid, these are all the things that I love, and now it's a book and you enjoy.
But you really have to take a leap to make that connection.
It's still more compelling, but there are still things that
don't. So you're saying this is to the nerd audience what that is to the
tween age girl
vampire.
That is one element of Twilight. It's the weakest element of Twilight in the comparison. Like when people think of Twilight,
the writing,
right? Like it's basically it's an abusive relationship is what Twilight is.
Twilight
We're
is
not
one
here
girl,
to talk about Twilight.
It's one girl choice between necrophilia and bestiality.
I disagree with the comparison that this is Twilight for nerds.
Moving on. Should we talk about...
I'm just saying that I can recognize why people say it.
Should we talk about what
the book's
about? I
don't agree.
I just
think that it exists.
Brief summary.
Yeah, brief summary.
Because nobody knows if they haven't read it what we're talking about.
Brief summary what the book's about. The book is set in a near future where the energy crisis has gone haywire. Cities are pretty much the epicenter of the nation. America is a shadow of itself.
People have like no food. They're homeless.
Yeah, and really where all the attention is drawn is to escapism and something called the Oasis, which is essentially the full realization of a virtual world and sort of 90s virtual reality future plus Second Life. Then you get this Oasis, basically, where anything is possible. You live
out
your fantasies.
People go to school in it. People play games in it. You can do absolutely anything.
I kind of hate to use USA Today's quote about the book as an example, but they kind of summed it up. It's the Matrix meets Willy Wonka.
Yeah, it's kind of, I can kind of see that, actually. Well, the story, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
well, it's like the Oasis is the logical conclusion to the MMO, essentially.
So what is the premise of this book?
The premise is that the fellow who invented the Oasis dies, and he very publicly leaves a message that he will give his entire kingdom, like control of the company and all the wealth that goes with it, to someone who finds an Easter egg that he's hidden in the game. It is a momentous challenge and a momentous prize, and he is obsessed with 1980s culture, as that's when he grew up and started game development and all that. And essentially, in order to find this Easter egg, you have to have an encyclopedic knowledge of that culture. The country goes crazy for it. Years pass, they can't find
anything. The entire world goes crazy.
Yeah, the whole world goes crazy. And then a whole culture comes to be based around finding these Easter eggs. They're called Gunters, which is short for egg hunters. Eventually, someone does find it, and it's an 18-year-old kid, and this is his story.
And it's kind of the events that happen from that point forward. And
it's about the mysteries of decoding all these clues, the social situations of this future society as to what happens when something like that goes on, and the economics of it, because there's a lot of people who want to seize control of this company, because it's basically where the world goes to hang out.
It basically has one of the highest, this like simulation has one of the highest economic values in the world.
Yeah, it was real currency. Probably it was the highest, because I mean, imagine, you know, Ultima at one point was the 13th richest country in the world. and this is sort of an extension of that very idea.
And it's also to play in a big detail is that Oasis, it costs money to start, but there's no monthly
fee.
It's
a quarter
thing.
Yeah. It's a quarter to sign up for it for the first time, harkening back to the whole arcade thing that the character Halliday was really big into. And then boom, free from there. Microtransactions are the way of the future. Thank you, EA. And so with all of essentially the world's commerce going on in here, there's a big drive to want to own this company to monetize it.
Right, because that's
where the villain, you know, the big bad comes into play, is essentially this giant company, IOI, which is going after the egg just as much as these Gunters are.
And they're like
going after the prize just as much as these Gunters are, so they can be in control of the Oasis. And then in turn, charge a monthly fee and et cetera, so that they can
the Willy Wonka comparison. It's basically Slugsworth, you know, like it's the
Slugworth.
But he turned out to be a test.
Wasn't that guy just an agent of the company?
He was an agent of Wonka.
Right. So it was not the company itself wasn't a ruse.
It's not a perfect analogy.
And anyway,
but it's the whole idea of what if Slugworth was real.
The culture is really interestingly presented. The dynamics of this semi apocalyptic future are very interesting. Both the social and political ramifications of it and economic ramifications of it are well handled. And we'll get into all that shortly. But when we come back, we're going to talk about what you guys, the listeners, thought about this book, and then we're going to share our thoughts with you and do a dramatic reading of a scene from it. But before then, we got to track, what is it going to be, Hex?
Well, since this is a book is steeped in 80s culture, I thought I'd have a bunch of 80s covers from their recent.
So this entire episode is going to be 80s covers?
Yeah.
Well, that's cool.
It's three songs, so it wasn't really that hard.
The whole episode.
The entire episode.
Yes.
All of it.
They'll be playing constantly in the background.
No, they won't. I don't have that many covers. Shut up. what we have is from the one-hit wonder Corey Hart, his Sunglasses at Night. We have the Megas rendition of that from their single Fly on the Dog.
So now we're going to talk about what you guys thought about Ready Player One. Shared a bunch of thoughts with us in the forums as you read it and just after you read it, all in one sitting.
Yeah. Speed, yeah, actually, Starf actually started the discussion on the forum, which was awesome. Thanks, Starf.
You go, Starf.
Starf, yeah. Starf, Starf. Starf.
One of his quotes, the quote from the forums was that, I thought when I was listening to the podcast that maybe I would be a little turned off by all the 80s references you guys talked about, seeing as how I was born in 1990. Obviously, I'm going to know a lot of it, but I didn't necessarily grow up with it, so I didn't know. But nothing is diminished even when I don't get the reference. So basically, he's saying that even though he did not necessarily grow up in the 80s and he didn't get every single reference, he really enjoyed the book.
I mean, it's true because I was born in the 80s, but like I was still young by the time the 80s ended. So I don't remember a damn thing about it, but I still get a lot of the references somehow.
Well, I mean, I was born in 1984, but I've willingly absorbed all that culture. I mean, it was still good timing for it, you know.
Lady Hawk. Mm-hmm.
Lady Hawk.
I think I just watched a lot of reruns of everything in the 90s. So I got my 80s culture in the 90s.
Mm. Yeah, I had parents who just were a big fan of all the movies from there. So a lot of the films that are referenced in this, I've seen. I grew up with the John Hughes stuff. I grew up with anything really featuring Matthew Broderick. So having this in the book was like...
What were some of your favorite references in the book? I mean, because this book, the big draw is, Cap just said it in the beginning in the intro, is that there's tons of references that everybody goes, oh my God, that's so great. What were some of the things that made you, that really caught you off guard and excited you? And some of the things that made you go, oh, really?
The thing that made me most excited was at the very beginning when they're talking about the video and the background music is Dead Man's Party, Boingo Boingo. At that point, I was all, okay, I'm going to like this. Because I am a total Oingo Boingo fanboy, so I was really excited that was deemed cool enough to be incorporated with all the rest of the 80s references.
Yeah, Cap, I was interested because as I was reading it, the very first time that I read it, because when I read it with Nerdy Show Book Club, that was the second time that I read it.
Right.
But the first time I read it, I was interested because I was like, holy shit. That's a, like, you know, we've grown up together, so I know all the things that you like for the most part. And I was like, Cap loves this.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Cap loves this.
Uh-huh.
Cap loves this.
Yeah.
Holy fuck. Cap loves all these things that they are pointing out in this book. So
it's
what
it's funny how you know what Cap likes more than your wife. Isn't that weird? What does it say about you, Colin?
We've known each other longer.
Yeah, you have. Yeah, you have. He knows how to fondle you.
He's impregnated me more often.
It's true, I have.
Brain babies.
Continue on.
Jelly babies. Anyway, yeah.
Jam buddies.
Oh my God. The thing about this book, the thing that made me so apprehensive, was it's so easy to name drop and to get people off just by mentioning things. I mean, it's, you know, Family Guy's comedy, the reason it failed is that it, you know, as I mean, obviously it's doing very well, but the reason that the reason that it's crashed and burned as far as people who were fans of it when it started is that it shifted over into a format that was so referential that it's just you know, you get sick of it.
To me, when he pulled up to the ball, the gala, uh-huh. in the DeLorean with the Ghostbusters logo and the Buckaroo Banzai device.
Yeah.
I was like, this is just, you're just...
He's masturbating. He's masturbating all over the page.
He is. But here's the thing about this book. I've discussed my apprehensions a lot because I want everybody to know just how critical I was looking at this book and how ready I was not set out to hate it, but how, you know, ready I was to find it lacking. However, even in an instance as excessive as that, I feel that Klein actually earns all of it. It's the from the first page. It did when in the first page they say drop the line from Ghostbusters that we ourselves are guilty of doing every other episode. Cats and dogs living together, mass hysteria, and I felt like that was. I read it and I groaned. I was like, oh, it's going to be like this, huh? Because it's obvious. I mean, we do it all the time, so it must be obvious, right? Mm-hmm. but that was it. That was the one instance that I didn't really truly feel was earned. He created a situation that lends itself so perfectly to the excess of all these name drops and everything. That I felt that even in the craziest scenarios, it still fit within the world he'd created so much that it really truly validated all this stuff. So his Uber car, his 80s Uber car, it's kind of brilliant. It's like, of course, in this world, that makes complete sense.
See, I felt the opposite. I felt like the author was looking for a reason to write a bunch of references for the 80s. And I felt like he created this entire story for that. Now, I love this book and I love this story, but the opening really, the beginning of the book really irked me because it's like, and then I walked into this room and there's like a Back to the Future poster and Ghostbusters. And then this song from like this 80s song was playing and he had this old 80s system. It's like everything 80s. I'm like, I get it. You love the fucking 80s. I fucking get it. Moving on to the story. But it's like every scene he has to describe everything that's 80s related. And it really bothered me. Like he was just doing it on purpose. And I understand the plot is you have to obsess about the 80s in this book in order to find this Easter egg. So I get that. But it's just, it was so overwhelming. I was like, if this was a movie, it would be better because you wouldn't have to keep describing it. I could just see it and we would move on.
There's a lot of that with it throughout this book. I really think it does work almost better as
later
a movie.
On it works really well. Just at the beginning I was like
I will disagree with you on the beginning because I felt the beginning was one of the strongest parts of the book. That opening chapter hooked me in such a way because it's that same, it's the scene from the opening of Willy Wonka. You're introduced to this enigmatic character, you're introduced to this contest, and it's world building in the best way. You're showing in that first chapter, he's really showing you and not telling you.
Well, I like that part with,
I mean, even as he's describing in intricate detail everything that's in this, he's showing you what this character was. He's showing you all of Halliday's obsessions and how important it was to him, how he didn't function in the real world, but just how well this oasis that he created for himself essentially fit him. But that first chapter also is where I start to run into somewhat of an issue because we're introduced to the character as a first person omniscient because he's telling the story from in the future. But there are times when he almost like flashes back to the present tense as he's going along. And that kind of inconsistency as I was going along kind of drew me out of it a little bit. But that could have also been because this is a book you need to read. This is not a book you need to listen to.
No. Right.
Yeah.
Right,
don't let Will Wheaton talk to you through your
Tony. Tell us your experience with your first experience with Ready Player One.
Well, yeah, because Studio Malam from the forums, he listened to the audiobook read by Will Wheaton and he loved it. So what do you think about it, Tony? Yeah,
nothing Will Wheaton does could possibly be better than like something else.
Shut up, Wesley! Off my bridge.
First off, Will Wheaton is very good at playing a particular kind of character.
He's not good at growing a beard.
He's decent at growing a beard. However. He is very, very good at playing an asshole.
He's not playing.
So he nailed Sorrento.
He nailed Sorrento. The problem is, I'm meant to relate to Parzival. Mm-hmm. And to have Will Wheaton's voice reading kind of nasally about everything that's going on, talking down to me in a very condescending way, starts to wear on you after a while.
So it gets to be all the references come off as being smug as fuck.
I know this.
Absolutely. Rah, rah, rah. And there is, in reading this book, because I've had the opportunity to go back and read it, especially after everybody else, because I came away from it going like, yeah, it's good, but there was a lot.
And then I was like, why the hell did you listen to it?
Punctuation makes this book.
So you're saying Will Wheaton doesn't do that very well.
No, I'm not. It has nothing to do with Will Wheaton. It has to do with the fact that as an audiobook, first chapter, and you guys can all attest to this, there's a lot of asterisks going into further detail as to what's going on in this scene. Now picture for a moment that all of those were read out.
Wait, he reads those out?
Uh-huh.
What?
And the scoreboard. Everybody who's read this book knows the scoreboard. Oh, and you know that you've got about four names.
Does he
and
read
you've
every
got
single line of the scoreboard?
Every time it shows up through the book.
With all of the Sixers numbered.
IOI 6575. I was like, oh my God.
Every single time. And there's this thing that Klein does throughout the book, and I still have a little bit of a problem with it in the written version in comparison to where it was, but it's like he knows that he's writing to the nerd audience with the references he makes, and like with the Ghostbusters thing, he just drops that line, cats and dogs living together, mass hysteria.
Right.
And just leaves that there.
Yeah.
Doesn't go into, that's a line from the Ghostbusters released in this year of this time with these actors, and it was written, but then you go into something else. Like explaining what XPs are in intricate detail. And it's like, especially when you're listening to this and you know that he's about to go on a 10 to 15 minute explanation to something that you know inside and out because you are as deeply steeped in this culture as Ernest Cline is.
I was going to say, if you don't know what XP is, why the fuck are you reading this book? It's not for you.
No, here's the thing though, Brandon, because what's interesting that you say that, Tony, is that I think that, you know, the cats and dogs living together, mass hysteria, even if it's not necessarily pointed out as to where it came from, like essentially like, so it's like you're not reading an essay and having citations. you know, there, you don't necessarily need a citation from that particular quote because it's, you know, it's going to be funny regardless. But the thing is that like things like XP or the description of Artemis's name and the fact that she has a three in the middle of her name, Alicia, when she read it,
that's Colin's wife.
That's my wife. Yeah, she was confused.
That's my wife.
That's my wife. And she was confused when she read it.
Is she not a nerd?
And I understand that to an extent.
Is, but of different things. She is a complete book nerd, and she, like, Victorian England, like, that kind of a
nerd. So not leet speak nerd.
Yeah, not leet speak nerd. More, so she doesn't necessarily understand XP and all that kind of stuff. So that actually really, she really appreciated a lot of that.
So not knowing that stuff, she still enjoyed the book, though.
She loved it. She's never played an MMO in her life. And
so these explanations are basically for people who don't understand that culture but still want to enjoy the book.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently it works, which is great, kind of surprising, really.
But even then, it's like the XPs were mentioned before he went into the long diatribe as to what it was.
Before we get into, I guess, talking about improvements on the book, let's back up a little bit about the story for people who are tuning in, who are just enjoying the discussion and not
understanding what the hell
not reading along with us. What you get is you get some really exciting moments. You get the first, and this is spoiler
the goal
country
is to
here,
find but, the egg, yeah. But there are clues and keys along the way
right,
to
you
help
gotta,
find
you,
the
you
egg.
You got to get three keys.
Three doors.
And open three doors, and then you get the final
And they're all hidden, and they all have challenges, they're all have clues.
And the world is... I mean, it's as big as the virtual world is, which is to say infinite.
There are millions of people.
Millions and millions of planets, each of which are rendered in complete detail.
You can make whatever you want.
You stare into the abyss.
And so it could be anywhere.
There's different levels of immersion into the Oasis. Basically, the way that the Oasis works is that you have to have a visor and a glove. Haptic gloves. So you have haptic gloves, but then eventually, like, you can upgrade your rig, and so you can actually run, and by running, that causes your avatar to run, and then you can have an even better tactile experience by wearing a haptic suit.
You can hook up an exercise program to it.
All this kind of stuff, so, yeah. Yeah. I mean, but, like, in terms of the size of the world, every single universe in nerd culture exists. All of Azeroth is in there. All of every single MMO that ever existed is in the Oasis.
There are worlds
Star Trek
devoted
next to Firefly, next to Star Wars,
next to the DC Universe Online,
next to Aliens, next to whatever.
Which
the hell.
Bizarrely didn't have Stephanie Brown.
And anyway, the first key is found in a.
Are we doing spoilers?
We're doing.
Cool?
Yeah. Well,
no, fuck it. You should have read it because we told you.
I did a little thing a couple minutes ago. You may have heard
we're
it.
We're in spoiler country now.
Anyway, we're in spoiler country. It's a very exciting book because it presents you with neat things where you're watching this character figure this out, and eventually he realizes that one of this riddle was talking about a very specific module of Dungeons and Dragons, and he figures out where in the universe the module is. Uses it to get through the dungeon and so on, and then the last
the funny part is that he's like what, like level 3, and he's a poor person in real life. He's got no money to like go to other planets.
He lives in the slums,
so he's been getting dropped off by high level people to fight like kobolds and like level 1 characters for years just to get to like level 3 and 4. So he like the first dungeon he goes to where this key's hidden, there's just like monsters and things that like are totally beyond him.
Yeah. And what's interesting is that did you guys have issue with figuring anything out? Did you figure out where it was prior to when Klein described where it was? Because
God, no. Are you insane?
Yeah, Derofago said that he figured the first riddle out pretty quickly and was wondering why no one else had figured that out in 5 years. He was like, why are people so dumb?
Did he
Are you serious? Because I could not figure out
I
any
mean, there
of
are
them.
Some people, like, I'm personally horrible with riddles, so... I read a riddle, I'm like, oh, okay, I'll wait till you figure that you to explain this.
How would he know that, like, Holiday's favorite, like, game back in the day was, like, this one D&D manual before described
it
in the book?
It does, like, that is an actual D&D module, so it
I guess if you're way into D&D from the 80s, then yeah, you might.
That's the whole point.
But then it's like, do you know that that's Holiday's? And maybe he knows that Latin, people who have much to learn...
Yeah,
and you know you have a.
But then he had to find out where this was located in the universe.
You know, personally, I knew the book was going to tell me sooner or later, so I didn't devote any time into figuring it out.
But off the top of my head,
Durafago is just that sharp. He knew all that.
He's a genius, I guess.
Yes, we do have to clear up though. Initially, is that when we talk about Halliday is the person who was running? Is the
dead designer.
the dead designer who created the Oasis, who is he's the one who is running everything. And then also the main character, his name is Wade, and his avatar's name is Parzival. So just want to get that out of the way.
And it's only Parzival because yeah. Percival, one of the Knights of the Round Table, was already taken, obviously. So we had to change it to
Clearly.
Parzival. Clearly.
Duh.
Every name I choose nowadays is fucking taken, even ones I created myself back in the day. It's fucking gotta add zeros and shit. Assholes fucking bitching stealing my name. Anyway,
in other news,
well, I have to say that the book I think does a good job at grabbing everyone, but it does it at different parts, which I found unusual. There's a spot for each one of us where it suddenly it's like you can't stop reading it. And for mine, it was like at the beginning I said I kind of had trouble getting into it because of all the 80s references and I don't really give a shit. Even though I got them, I just was like, okay, I get it,
right?
But then there's a point where he meets Sorrento. And I want to say face to face, but
the
like
guy who leads the evil corporation.
Yeah, the IOI or whatever it's called. Then shit gets real. And I was like, are you kidding me? Did that just happen in this book? What the fuck? I didn't realize the book was going to go this like this type of direction. And from that point on, I was like, I cannot put this book down ever.
That's what happened for me.
You realize how high the stakes are. They're very
like,
high.
Wait, did that happened? What? Well, okay.
No, I thought that was brilliant on Klein's part to take it from you're dealing with a predominantly MMO, completely virtual space where, yes, if you die, you lose your character and all this kind of stuff, blah, 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 blah. But like the stakes are not high in that.
But what if the stakes were like, you are going to die in real life?
In RL, you are going to die.
And not just kill you, but it's done in the most like cold, like, unfeeling, brutal
your
corporate
parents, like, your neighborhood, everyone, and they'll think it was an accident. And we're there right now while you're here. And it's like, oh fuck, you are fucked. And spoilers, by the way.
No, I love that's another everything from him discovering where it was up to the explosion. Yeah. I was so ridiculously caught up in every problem that I had with Will Wheaton having to go over everything was gone.
The writing was that good that you're like, I don't care if Will Wheaton's telling it to me now. I'm enthralled with this.
Pretty much. But then there was this weird kind of let off with that. And I had a hard time believing that an 18-year-old kid was going to be smarter than a giant corporation. And he was
you know how smart kids are nowadays? I see 5-year-olds using iPods and iPads better than I fucking know how and hacking computers and shit, dude.
I mean, really.
They'd be having sex in elementary school now.
To try to award myself with a no prize here, you know, I think it's mostly a matter of the big corporation is obviously, just judging by the way they operate in this book, in this universe, they're so blinded by their own superiority compared to everybody else that it's the sort of thing they just take it for granted.
They're sniffing their own farts.
But they talk about how they hire every expert and person.
Experts are only as good as the information that they know. When it comes to like, you know, thinking of something like, well, you know, why would the kid not be in the house? Why would he have like a secret lair? They just do what they need to do.
And this is
they think he lives in the stacks. He lives in the slums. You know, they assume that they know what he's capable of, and they underestimate him because they don't know what that is like.
Also, everyone in this world is pretty much stupid because they're all poor, they're all hungry, and I'm just like, it's basically there's this system of indentured servitude. So all these people that work for this major corporation are basically slaves.
And I do get that. I do. But his character kept going around. He kept doing stuff. And I felt like eventually he would have been tracked down. I mean, I went onto the black market and purchased myself a new identity that seemed kind of like a Deus Ex easy way out in a way.
Yeah. It totally was. There was like, it was.
That took me out of the rise.
But what about the part when he talks about when like the IOI, they run all of the internet connections. So we had to use one that wasn't owned by them. And I thought that was pretty clever.
No, that was clever.
Because then they couldn't track
it directly.
But it was a
lot of, it still seemed like it was so very convenient that there happened to be one that they didn't own. And
we
just
had to move there.
Kept pushing my suspension of disbelief.
I don't know if that's convenient. Point where, I think that that's just accurate world building, honestly.
No, and maybe it is. Maybe if I had read this book, reading it first, I wouldn't have been so taken out of it. But when I'm dealing with the letdown from the adrenaline coming off, Will Wheaton's droning nasally voice.
What happened is Will Wheaton hyped you up and then he let you down. It was Will Wheaton that let you down.
It was, but it was the pairing of Will Wheaton with the words on the page. And I feel
like
if you have
the wrong type of fruit with the wrong type of cheese, it doesn't work out.
Pretty much.
You need the right pairing, Hex.
Because again, I do want to stress that I enjoyed this book. I listened through to the end to find out what happened to these characters. because the characters are written well. I honestly enjoyed learning about the other characters in this world more than I enjoyed learning about Wade.
One of the things who is absolutely Parsable. Yeah, one of the things that I absolutely love about this book though is it does with the social awkwardness of finding out what a person's really like.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Versus what their avatar online is, and at some point they do have to deal with that. You know, are you male? Are you female? Are you a 40-year-old dude in the basement hitting on me?
Like Chuck.
Yeah. So I mean, it's really funny, all that shit.
Okay, so let's hear a little bit more from what people thought from the forums.
On the forums, a lot of people were talking about how they felt that Parzival was so good at so many things that they thought that it was convenient that he was so good at all of these things. Starf thought that as well as Gary Ure, they felt that he was just potentially too good at.
See, I understand that, but at the same time, they're trying to describe a character in the book that this is all he's ever done his whole life.
I think the thing is, this is an adventure and entertainment story. And the fact is, the only way this story could be told is if it was told by the person who won the contest.
Right.
And the person who won the contest is going to be the person who's qualified to win the contest.
But even so, later on, the other characters, even themselves, don't believe that he has done some of the things that he's done. And he actually writes that into the book. Like, closer to the end, they're like, you actually did this by yourself? Like, that's impossible. How did you do this?
I mean, like, Artemis didn't believe that he had...
Like, infiltrated and did all that shit in real life. And she's like, no, that stuff, too.
At the very beginning, he would have actually, on his first attempt...
Yeah.
Won the joust against the Lich.
Yeah, and see, like, even other characters point out that this character is too good to be true, which is kind of funny.
Parzival is OP, this campaign is broken.
Yeah.
But so. No, I see where they're coming from, but I see also enough failing. There are so many faults in these characters.
Yeah, and the main character fails several times and realizes it, and he's like, I am a fucking idiot.
Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, he had no idea where the fuck to go for the second key.
And he was being lazy as hell.
He was being lazy as hell. Third key.
Depressed.
Don't even get me started on third key. Third key was just sad.
He just fucked up. Yeah.
So it wound up being that he was good at what he needed to do there.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like having a hammer and no nails.
And he wasn't good enough to find some of the keys, and to the point where, like, he was like, okay, I can't do this, so in the real world, I'm gonna do this and see if I can fuck these people over, because there's no way I'm doing this or winning.
Yeah, that's what Cassie Muldrow said. She said that she didn't find it strange that Parzival was so good at the majority of tasks, and that she felt that he had enough difficulty with deciphering the clues to balance out how good he was at figuring out when he got to the keys and the gates.
Mm-hmm. To go back to the construction thing, just because you can actually build the house doesn't mean you can design it.
Exactly.
Right.
So I feel that the other characters did balance, because again, I love these other characters. H was exceptionally compelling. I really enjoyed Artemis. Shoto and Daito were a lot of fun. I liked seeing that kind of brother dynamic because I'm a big fan of brothers in anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, they were compelling. I wanted more of them.
Especially, he's especially a big fan of Brocess novels.
It's really, yes, I am.
And Supernatural.
Brocess novel, TV show.
Supernatural, erotic fan fiction, Ninja Turtles erotic fan fiction, anything with brothers kissing each other's dicks. That's Tony Muldoon for you.
Oh, God, guys, please. I need to record and go to my cold place.
Yep.
What were we talking about before that happened?
The other characters in the book and how great. I really wanted to know more about Sorrento. I really wanted to know more about Sorrento.
There is a story there. There's definitely a story there. Like, and there,
I mean, he's just a corporate goon who gets paid a shit ton of money.
No, he's not.
He designed some very compelling role playing games.
In the past. That's right. They did talk about how back in the day he was a designer and creator, and then he got recruited for his skills.
He's the one who's willing to pull the trigger to kill an 18-year-old boy.
They're so blinded by their greed of wanting to get Halliday's, egg, and that they will stop at nothing win this contest.
I don't even see Sorrento as being the guy who will stop. Sorrento, to me, is kind of like Slade Wilson, a Deathstroke, where he's a mercenary, a gun for hire.
Pretty much, he doesn't run the company. He works for it.
He gets paid for them, so it's not his greed that's doing this necessarily.
But he does take it personally at some point.
I disagree because he's the one who always is constantly in the book when they go through the gate and then later on in the book, IOI is the one who actually figures out one of the keys in the gates. before our hero Gunters. And Sorrento is always the first IOI avatar to go through the gate and get the key. Always the first one.
Right.
I would argue less greed, more pride, hubris.
Maybe.
Like, I think I definitely like the comparison of Slade Wilson, where it's like there's a reason that he's doing what he's doing, and it's money, but he could be doing a lot of things right now. He's doing what he's doing because he loves it.
He also might be killed if he doesn't do what he's doing. We don't know that.
The corporation was pretty dismissive of him. You know, they were ready to throw him away simply to get a
layoff. That was a hilarious part. By the way, when he's like, I'll give you this information, but I want your job. I bet your higher ups are listening to this right now. Have they agreed to that? And he's just like, damn it. He's like, yes, they have. And he's like, never mind then. But I wanted you to know that. And like, and he's like, you shouldn't have done that. And then this shit gets even worse.
Fuck your stack, motherfucker.
Yeah, no, it was great. We definitely need to put a disclaimer for this episode. Like, if you want any enjoyment from this book, please, for the love of God, read it before you listen to all of these spoilers.
And Will Wheaton reading it.
Yeah, don't. And please do not listen to it.
I didn't fully get information from you guys as to what was something that was really a reference that really surprised you guys. We kind of got off on a little tangent, but was there something that that really surprised you?
Well, I mean,
or excited your nerd cockles?
My nerd cock is honestly always excited.
At least for me, outside of the Lady Hawk reference, because I'm a huge Lady Hawk nut, War Games being the first I did not see that coming.
I was kind of excited about that. And it was like,
hold on a second. What? No.
Wait, explain that part to me again, because
after they pass through the first gate and they're enacting War Games?
Oh, you're like, okay, so they go through the first gate and you're like, oh, what's this really hard challenge? What monster is he going to fight? What puzzle is he going to have to solve? And it's like, reenact War Games, scene for scene, word for word, gesture by gesture.
I'm not lying. The moment I finished the book, I put on War Games.
Yeah, your character dies.
And actually, War Games was something that I've heard of for a very long time, but never actually seen.
What? Oh. Did you go and see it?
Same thing for me. I read that book before I saw War Games.
It's been hovering in my Netflix instant queue for a couple years now. Oh. So I saw that was the case. My list of things to do was not crushing me, so I went over and I watched War Games.
Oh, how was it?
It was very good. Yeah. I enjoyed it quite a bit.
It's amazing how it still stands up.
It does. It's very good. I mean, I like to think of War Games is someplace in between like Miracle Mile and Real Genius. Like
Have you seen Project X yet, or whatever that's called?
No.
The one with the monkeys and Matthew Broderick. That one's a sad movie.
Yes, it is.
Except that, you know, fuck monkeys.
Brandon hates monkeys, like Star Fox.
Ugly.
anyway, so it's like kind of a lighthearted 80s nuclear war paranoia film.
Yeah.
Somehow.
No, Gary Ure actually said that one thing that he found is that anything referenced in Ready Player One is great. Whenever he's bored, he looks up a reference in the book, and he looks for a reference in Ready Player One, looks it up, and it's always great.
Spider-Man.
Yeah, that was a weird one. That's one that I know of and have very limited experience with. I'm always thrilled to know that there's people out there in important places who, you know, support Buckaroo Banzai and the Banzai Institute. I think that's very important to me to know that I like when he references things without calling attention to his references. When Parzival was infiltrating IOI and he just threw out a couple casual Brazil references for no reason. Just there they are.
Wait, did he? I may not have gotten them.
Yeah.
I've seen that movie too. But it's
Sam Lowry, Harry Tuttle or Harry Buttle.
Yeah.
Oh, that's where that's from.
Yep.
Oh, now I get it.
Yeah, it was cool to just, you know, to see that in there.
Mostly, I chuckled to myself on that one too.
You know, they're not laugh out loud things, but it's just fun acknowledgments, and you know,
they're Easter eggs.
Yeah, they are. You know, if you like, you know, referencing things, then party on.
I guess the book itself is riddled with Easter eggs.
Well, there was an Easter egg in this.
There was a competition to win a DeLorean in the paperback edition of Ready Player One.
Wait, seriously?
Seriously.
Fuck! Did you get it?
No,
idiot.
Well, actually, Florida was win. Yeah, it was some kind of Florida law prohibits people from having participated in the contest
from owning DeLoreans. What the fuck? It kills too many birds when you open those sideways doors. They think it's a giant bird.
There's a Florida law against us even participating.
Yes.
Yep.
Why?
I don't recall.
It was like participation.
There are too many
everyone
people who were around in the 80s living in Florida right now.
It was unfair.
I remember when this came out, I was looking at the clauses and was scanning through it and saw like that Florida was not, they couldn't participate. So,
well, what was this like Easter egg? What did you have to do? I mean, it's a book. What could you possibly?
There was something
done?
In the book.
It was essentially just like what Halliday had done.
But
with
how
his
could
Easter
you have
hunt?
Even known what it is? It's just all text.
Well, that's the thing. There were like some misprints or something like that.
And also it. That I think the trail of clues started on the cover. There was a new cover created for it with a picture of a stack.
Well, that's what the stacks look like. That's fucking scary,
isn't it?
That shit is scary.
As far as the book on the whole goes, I was pretty satisfied with it. Like I didn't expect to enjoy it. I did end up enjoying it quite a bit. I'm conflicted over where the book ends.
Yeah.
It definitely, you know, it's always good for, you know, for a book to not wrap itself up completely, and putting a bow on a story in, you know, is kind of cliche and whatnot. However, this book had so much world building and background information and embellishment and everything. It seemed like there should have been another chapter. It was leading you up to that point. You want the freeze frame where you find out what happened to all the kids after detention.
See, that's
yes,
why I
yes. precisely.
Okay, see, I kind of like that they didn't do that for one reason, because they each talked about what they may or may not do with the money if they won it, and then suddenly they won, and the main character's like, you know, I'm going to split it with all of you because you helped me. That was the deal. And then it ends. And I like that you don't actually see how or what they use it for, if that makes any
sense.
Well,
that'll, that, you know, Cap, that chapter will be in the sequel, The Quest for More Money.
well, the thing is that I know
Ready Player Two.
There's
Luigi.
I mean, maybe Klein's got an idea, but I don't actually see that there's ever that, you know, this book was created with a very specific format, a premise and a world.
I don't think you can make a sequel.
Right, exactly.
I think it's like a standalone.
It was a premise and a world that allowed itself to have exactly one function and tell exactly one kind of story. If another story was told in this world, it would be very much like the sequel to Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Charlie and the Great Glass Elevator, or Willy Wonka and the Great Glass Elevator. I don't know, but it was awful.
Is that Tim Burton one?
No, that is a book by Roald Dahl, and Roald Dahl, and the sequel to Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is fucking wretched.
Yep.
It's an inexplicable sci-fi story, it makes no sense, the characters are completely out of context, and that would be what the sequel to Ready Player One would be like.
Yeah.
So, this is the one chance for him to tell the story with these characters and discuss the world and a lack of resolution at the end of the book, because one of the unspoken character of this book is the world that he set it in, and the economical climate, and so on. And you want to know what's going to happen.
Well,
because,
the thing is that the world is so bad that even them winning this, if he were to write another chapter about what they did with the money, you would expect it has to be a happy ending, but it couldn't be in that world, no matter what. They could live their lives, but the world's still fucked. And if he kept trying to write on, he might make some sort of cookie cutter, and then the world was fine, and everyone was happy.
He doesn't need to solve all the problems till the end of time in this last chapter, just at least get things started. I mean, basically...
But it's too complicated of an ending, I think, because they wanted to help the world, and it would go on. There's no easy way to write that in one chapter.
Sure, there's no easy way. It doesn't mean it shouldn't be done.
There's a flip side of that. He could have ended it maybe a chapter earlier, because you have that final meeting with Halliday that kind of linger on the button that shuts everything down.
And then it ends.
And then it ends with him giving Parzival the choice. Because what I think we're running into in the end of this is that we have gotten some sense of closure. You know, he goes outside.
I love that, by the way, that hidden button.
Yeah, I mean, that was genius.
That's fucked up.
That kind of will he or won't he, ending it right there, leaves you with more questions, leaves you wanting more, but gives you resolution to the story that's been told. The only thing it doesn't wrap up with a pretty little bow is the love story between Parzival and Artemis, which I honestly felt was one of the weakest parts of the book.
Totally.
I have to say, though, being the old softy I am that you know me to be, I absolutely loved the last two sentences in the book.
No, and they were beautiful. I'm not going to deny that. It was a little...
It's like this whole thing where he's like a shut-in. He loves being online and all this stuff, and that's all he has. And then he's just like, and for the first time ever, I don't give a damn about being logged into the Oasis.
No, but it's basically, we're set up, hey, so I'm this kid, and I have this total crush on this one girl. Oh my gosh, she happens to be at the first key right when I'm there.
Well, he had a crush on her because she had her own blog and she was super smart and loved all the same things
right,
in the 80s.
But
he was like an obsessive.
It's just a, what a coinky dink. We're at the first key at the same time.
And then they're so hopelessly in love with each other and this and that. And then she's in the middle of the maze. Don't worry. It's an easy one. You'll figure it out quickly. It's that last chapter.
She was actually
forced,
way smarter than him, though.
That last chapter feels forced and largely unnecessary because it's giving us information we already have and just kind of giving that self-gratification of, oh, they do wind up together.
She's still kind of like a flake with image issues, you know, like it is. I mean, it is what it is. I mean,
they only kissed once.
I don't really take it to mean much of anything, but it basically, I felt like there could have been more there. I felt the world was what was unresolved. Like I was left wanting.
Okay. The end of the book obviously should have been like, we won the contest while we were celebrating.
But we lost the war.
We did not notice the giant asteroid heading for the Earth, and then all went dark. And that's where it would have ended.
But again, going back to the kind of leaving it on the button thing, kind of leaves the world ambiguous. Kind of leaves it with. I mean,
that
would piss people off.
That would be awesome. Oh, yeah. That would be awesome. But then you'd be like, well, we never got to the. He really wanted to see Artemis in real life, and he never got there. When are we going to get to read that part?
You would have to put that.
Because he's waiting half the book to be like, I need to meet.
Because
this
there would
person.
Be no character resolution.
Yeah.
If that happened. And right now, there's still not enough character resolution.
I like that he achieved God mode. I was like, hells yeah, do anything to help anywhere, fuck money, bam, highest level spells you ain't got, dead character, fuck you. Like, I love it.
That last chapter, that part was so good because I did feel that sense of resolution. I felt like this is what we had built toward. And well, I mean, I would even argue that there would still be some character resolution simply because there's a lot of himself in Halliday, and it's Halliday telling him, you don't need the Oasis, that I spent too much of my life on this, don't be like me. And to have had him unplug and leave, I'm not necessarily saying linger on the button itself, like, will he press it?
What he's saying is, don't spend your life on World of Warcraft, people, because you're just going to get fat and lazy sitting there, and you're going to have health problems, you're not going to enjoy it.
Watch the episode of Star, my brother
met his wife there, so that's weird, but whatever.
I mean, South Park kind of summed that up, but...
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they did.
Anyway, let's cut to a song. And when we get back, we're going to read an excerpt of one of our favorite parts of Ready Player One.
DJ Robo Rob was in a synth pop band called Robotronica, and one of the songs they covered was Dead or Alive's Spin Me Right Round, and I thought that'd be appropriate for this here episode.
The video game Dead or Alive?
I hate you.
No, okay. It is. Yeah. It's just this Dead or Alive disc because it spins right round.
God damn it. I hate everything.
Sorry.
had an interesting little tidbit dropped on us from one of our friends in the forums, Gary Ure. Colin, what was up with that?
Gary Ure pointed out that the biggest misstep for Klein was the Tomb of Horrors section. Quote, Klein clearly did not read the module. He just skimmed the wiki.
What?
Yeah, Acerak is just a floating skull. No body. He doesn't appear on the cover of the module. What Klein was describing was the decoy zombie that appears earlier in the tomb. What Wade claimed to have already bested. It's a minor thing, especially when you compare it to the rest of the nerdy novel, but it bugged the crap out of me when I read it.
And when it's a book all about the mundane nerdy details.
And nitpicking and having read something back to back cover to cover.
That's what nerd culture is all about right there.
Yeah. And that's the catch 22.
He did mention, I think he mentioned in the book that when this lich thing appeared that he wasn't supposed to be there, didn't he? He was like, this isn't supposed to be
there.
But
he's a full lich lord.
That he described something that was not what was actually...
A Sararak.
Yeah.
So, yeah. No, it was,
send all your emails to ErnestKlein.gmail.
No, but it's a catch 22 that he wrote himself into, considering the fact that, like, you know, he's writing this nerdy novel. So, you know, you're going to be fact checked by a million people.
Do you think he just Wikipedia'd like the 80s and just looked at every possible note and reference and just like, I'm throwing everything in this fucking book. Like, yes. What kind of vehicle is he coming at? DeLorean, Ghostbusters, no, says Ecto-1 on it.
That's all easy peasy, right off the cuff stuff.
But there were a lot of references I didn't get, like some of the old Japanese shows and stuff, so... He must have known some, unless he Wikipedia'd 80s Japanese shows.
You can assume that he has.
We can do this all day, but yeah, I shouldn't because I like the book. So it's a good book regardless.
Overall, do we recommend Ready Player One?
Yes.
Yes.
Does it? Does it get the Aunt Nancy seal of approval?
And how?
Yes. It gets 4 out of 5 elements.
Oh, that's pretty good. Coming
well, and see, the thing is like, normally I can't finish a book because it's boring. So the only books I read are about birds, but this I couldn't put down. So obviously it's good if it got my attention. I get bored really fucking easily.
Mm-hmm. So. But you don't have to take our word for it.
And now, a reading from Ready Player One.
My chances of surviving one-on-one combat with a demi-lich were non-existent. My wimpy +1 flaming sword couldn't even affect him. And the 2 magic rubies in his eye sockets had the power to suck out my avatar's life force and kill me instantly. Even a party of 6 or 7 high-level avatars would have a difficult time defeating him. I silently wished, not for the last time, that the Oasis was like an old adventure game that I could save my place, but it wasn't, and I couldn't. If my avatar died, it would mean starting over with nothing. But there was no point in hesitating now. If the Lich killed me, I would come back tomorrow night and try again. The entire tomb should reset when the Oasis server clock struck midnight. If it did, all the hidden traps I disarmed would reset themselves and the treasure and magic items would reappear. I tapped the record icon at the edge of my display so that whatever happened next would be stored in a vidcap file I could play back and study later. But when I tapped the icon, I got a recording not allowed message. It seemed that Holiday had disabled recording inside the tomb. I took a deep breath, raised my sword, and placed my right foot on the bottom step of the dais. As I did, there was a sound like cracking bones as Acerak slowly lifted his head. The rubies in his eye sockets began to glow with an intense red light. I took several steps backward, expecting him to leap down and attack me, but he didn't rise from the throne. Instead, he lowered his head and fixed me with his chilling gaze.
"Greetings, Parzival,"
he said in a rasping voice.
"What is it that you seek?"
This caught me off guard. According to the module, the Lich wouldn't speak. He was just supposed to attack, leaving me with no choice but to kill him or run for my life.
"I seek the copper key,"
I replied. Then I remembered I was speaking to a king. So I quickly bowed my head, dropped to one knee, and added,
"Your Majesty!"
"Of course you do,"
Acerak said, motioning for me to rise.
"And you've come to the right place."
He stood, and his mummified skin crackled like old leather as he moved. I clutched my sword more tightly, and still anticipating an attack.
"How can I know that you are worthy of possessing the copper key?"
he asked. Holy shit! How the hell was I supposed to answer that? And what if I gave the wrong answer? Would he suck out my soul and incinerate me? I racked my brain for a suitable reply. The best I could come up with was...
"Allow me to prove my worth, noble Acerak!"
The Lich let out a long and disturbing cackle that echoed off the chamber's stone walls.
"Very well,"
he said.
"You shall prove your worth by facing me in a joust."
I'd never heard of an undead Lich King challenging someone with a joust, especially not in a subterranean burial chamber.
All right,
I said uncertainly.
But won't we be needing horses for that?
Not horses,
he replied, stepping away from his throne.
Birds, motherfucker.
He waved a skeletal hand at his throne. There was a brief flash of light, accompanied by a transformation sound effect, which I was pretty sure had been lifted from the old Super Friends cartoon. The throne melted and morphed into an old coin-operated video game cabinet. Two joysticks protruded from its console panel, one yellow and one blue. I couldn't help but grin as I realized the name on the game's backlit marquee. Joust. Williams Electronics, 1982.
Best 2 out of 3 games!
Vassarak rasped.
If you win, I shall grant you what you seek.
What if you win?
I asked, already knowing the answer.
Well, if I am victorious,
the Lich said, the rubies in his eye sockets blazing even brighter.
Then you shall die!
A ball of swirling orange flame appeared in his right hand. He raised it threateningly.
Of course,
I said.
That was my first guess. Just wanted to double check.
The fireball in Asrak's hand vanished. He stretched out his leathery palm, which now held 2 shiny quarters.
The games are on me,
he said. He stepped up to the joust machine and dropped both quarters into the left coin slot. The game emitted 2 low electronic chimes, and the credit counter jumped from 0 to 2. Asrak took hold of the yellow joystick on the left side of the control panel and closed his bony fingers around it.
Art thou ready?
He croaked.
Yeah!
I said, taking a deep breath. I cracked my knuckles and grabbed the Player 2 joystick with my left hand, poising my right hand over the flap button. Asrak rocked his head from left to right, cracking his neck. It sounded like a snapping tree branch. Then he slapped the 2-player button, and the joust began. But don't take my word for it. All right, let's give some shout-outs to some amazing people. First and foremost, everybody who commented on the forums and joined us in reading along with this book.
The members who participated on the forum posting for Ready Player One were Starf, Studio Malam, Durafago, Mopkins, Garrier, Tolan, Cassie Muldrow, and Hatching Phoenix.
Such a nice guy, that Hatching Phoenix.
Is he a brother of Joaquin Phoenix?
No.
Well, one's Joaquin,
however, he,
and one's Hatching.
No.
And just like Hatching.
No.
He puts himself out in the river, Phoenix.
And of course, Nerdy Show, both the podcast and the network are listener supported. You make this show possible, and we couldn't do it without you. So far, the month of March 2013 has been insane. You guys are the fucking bee's knees.
Bees don't have knees.
They do now because our fans gave them to them.
Bees have like 2 knees on all 6 of their legs. They got knees.
Knees require bones.
They have external bones.
Interesting. They want those support perks, man.
I guess they do, and we've got some hot
support
I listened
perks. To some of them, and they were hilarious.
We got with the new one for this month, the first one, that is, until we... Well, actually, we've got 2 so far. You guys hit our initial $300 goal, our monthly goal, to just get our bare minimum costs in 3 days or so. It was nuts. So we've got 2 support perks out there right now. A 20-minute long selection of outtakes from our Nerdy Show Prime episode, Mask Justice. 20 minutes.
What?
That's kind of insane.
It's ridiculous. Also, the thing that was unlocked by you guys was a selection of celebrity and Nerdy Show in-house bumps from that other nerdy radio station we used to run. Now, of course, right now we've got Nerdy FM. It's a 24/7 nerd music station, and that also is something that you guys support with your wonderful, wonderful hard-earned money, which you so generously give to us.
We love you all.
We give back in any way we can think to the new podcasts, Nerdy Show, Nerdy FM, and all the support perks that you get in the mail. And we got to give shout-outs to everybody who's contributed so far. If you guys leave messages with us when you support us, well, then we read them. That's how it goes.
Unless it's like 10 pages long, because we have to be realistic about it.
Well, maybe. It depends if it's is it a good 10 pages. I mean, because, you know, we could.
Bonus perk, if you 10 want, page.
Learn grammar and sentence structure. Sure.
If you guys want us to give any shout outs to anybody special in your life or anything else, you can be like, yo, Sandra, it's your birthday.
This one goes out to the wonderful Alicia from Nerdy Show to you. Aw, yeah.
Yes, or we can be bought.
Yeah. Or you could be like, I have a crush on blah blah girl 72 on Facebook. This is for you.
I assume it's not going to be like, you know, a roller rink DJ call outs, but it could be.
No, whatever you want. It totally could be.
You know, you got a special somebody you wanted to say something to or do
something. Like, I'm blah 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 and my penis is 12 inches.
Or do something
long.
To.
Heck, when you get done to come back, he'll do his Wolfman Jack.
What? I have a problem with roller DJs. I have a problem with roller skate DJs because when I was 10, they called out like, you know, only 10 and up skate. And I went to go skate and the guys were like, nope, can't do it because I look too young. And they're like, nope, can't do it. And I was pissed. So I threw my skate at the DJ.
You are a little bastard.
I'm going to say that seems to be
kicked out of the roller rink and was never allowed back.
That seems to be less of a problem with the DJ, Colin, and more of a problem with you and God and him not
10,
letting you grow.
It, he was going to know. That was a 10-year-old arm throwing that skate.
You should have showed him your ID.
Did you hit him?
No, I was not. If I was 11, I would have hit him.
I like how we banned a 10-year-old for life. Because he was upset. It's like, well, you know what, 10-year-old? Never come back! Get out of here! I just picture you getting thrown across into a dumpster, and then you have to crawl out and walk home.
No, you see, that would only work, though, if Colin looked the same for the rest of his... Oh,
he does. Can you still get into that 10 and up night? Or no, has that still been
no,
a problem?
No, they still won't let me.
And I have an ID and everything, and they keep saying it's fake.
That's right. You're 9, kid. Get out of here.
I'm 30! You're 9, you bastard.
So that was a heck of a diversion. Okay. thanks to Dumpstat, Mauron, Nova Nerds, Sean Red, Big Bad Shadow Man, Kevin Wise, Trench 88,
and Walt Ribeiro
of 4 Orchestra, who recently guest starred on an interview on Mark with a C's The Real Congregation. Actually, that's worth talking about. This week's Real Congregation is, in fact, a Nerdy Show microsode transformed into a full 2-hour episode of The Real Congregation. It was a request by Jeffrey Voss, because every $100 mark, when you donate to us, you get to choose a microsode topic for us to talk about. Jeffrey Voss wanted Mark with a C to talk about cover songs, and he said, hey, possibly Walt Ribeiro from 4 Orchestra could be on that episode. And Mark said, you know what, dude, that sounds like a good idea. How about I just make it a whole episode? And so it happened. It came to pass.
It's not unusual for a 15 to 30 minute episode to run 2 hours.
But, you know, there it is. So, I mean, thanks to everybody. Thanks to Walt for supporting us. That's really cool. And we got some words. You folks had some things to say. Mauron said, "As a ranger, we all love him. We love him so much.
He's my number one son, though.
He is your number one son. You're his daddy, and he sprang from your boin loins.
Your boin loins?
See.
Boin loins. I like that. I never heard it before. Boin loins. Hey, Hex, how your boin loins doing?
It's funny every time.
Hex Crotch
represent. As the range of content and regularity of its release continues, I want to increase my monthly subscription fee as the value of what you guys are delivering increases. Keep up the great work. Mauron is a peach.
But that's terrible, because that means if we ever slip or get lazy or do shit, he will decrease the amount he is.
Well, the pressure.
No. So we need to not
the pressure's on. We can't let our number one son down.
No, we can't.
Right. Mauron is a really rad dude who loves what we put out so much that he considers that he pays a subscription fee, and that's cool.
That's essentially what he does.
We will never ask that of you, but no. Mauron, yeah, you're our number one son. You're amazing. Nova Nerds is a blog from the Tri-State Virginia, D.C., Maryland area. They contributed to us and they said, way overdue and happily sent. You guys have been and continue to be amazing throughout the years. Thanks so much for the content. See you soon. Yours always, Nova Nerds.
See you soon.
That's kind of ominous.
Are they going to show up?
Well, I mean, if, for example, I assume they were probably at MAGFest with you, Hex.
Oh,
well, there's something I've got to tell you guys. In this closet next to us, what you haven't known the whole time is that they've been in here, and let me get them out.
Oh my god.
Let me get them out.
Brandon, you didn't feed them. Brandon, you didn't feed them.
Let me get them.
Brandon,
out.
Oh, the stink.
Oh shit, you're supposed to feed them. Oh shit. So when you have surprise guests you keep in the closet for several days because you're not really sure when the recording's going to happen, make sure you leave them food and a way to get out of the closet. But now they're just skeletons, and I feel bad.
I'm a little embarrassed.
That's actually...
I've been taking whores in this recording studio.
I am disturbed because decomposition doesn't work that fast.
No, there's...
For them to be skeletons now, there must have been something wrong with them Nova Nerds.
No, there's spiders and ants in this house. Lots of them.
big bad Shadow Man. He contributed to us and he said, I have a long list of ideas for microsodes and I want to get some of them out. And we have a long list of ideas for your microsodes that we still will be recording and releasing as the year goes on. But we're always happy to take on more. It's wonderful fun. He also contributed again and said, here's $10 for the best Pokeballs of Steelix so far.
Aww. Yeah.
Loved how everyone pretty much lost their shit as the shit hit the fan.
Just wait for part two.
Yeah, we recorded two episodes at once by accident. And
it was just that good.
Yeah.
Did you hear how they ended the cliffhanger?
No.
It's with James C. dangling the cigar over the inside the
gas tank of the van.
Well, you know, the way Jamesy works with everything, be disappointed. Because nothing Jamesy does that looks like it's about to be badass ever works. Because everyone hates him.
However, if you want something set on fire, clearly you have to look to Martin.
roles get reversed. Cats and dogs.
Living together.
Mass hysteria.
Yeah.
Kevin Weiss said, I found some money. I found more money. Take it.
I like it.
I like the way he works. He finds money and shoves it at people. So long as we're those people.
And Trench88 said,
oh, you boss.
Yeah, he is. He is a boss. Figure you've got D&D comic costs or some other cool project in the works. And he made a very, very generous contribution. Trench88 has contributed so much to the show that he is, in fact, a legit producer of the show.
He's great. And he just bought a motorcycle.
He did.
I think.
He might be coming to MegaCon to visit us.
Woo!
Oh, that's awesome.
Yay! Yeah.
Hooray!
Has he reached status beyond boss? Is he now a Hugo boss?
He might be a...
He's a boss and Nova nerd.
What, no?
Hugo boss.
No. I don't know. I don't... You know, Hugo boss is a joke, but I don't know if it's a good joke.
Well, there was... He was a mini boss, now he's a boss, and then he will be final boss?
Well, he could be a final boss. All right. Yeah, anyway, Trench88 is a king. A true king and a prince.
You can't be a true king and a prince.
He was a prince, and now he's a king.
Okay.
Okay. And we are working on D&D issue 2. It should be out sometime in the near future, about within the quarter. Yeah. As well as the Chair mini comic, Chair's Last Stand, which is about Chair's final battle. So we're very excited about that, and we do have a lot of cool projects coming. So this is a project that we've been kind of kicking around for a little while now, and we just found out how much it would cost. And though it's a lot, it's actually surprisingly cheap for what it is. As you might remember, last year Hex was VMAC. He was dressed as VMAC at MegaCon. And it was incredible. But a pretty easy thing to do because Hex and VMAC are relatively the same size.
Yeah. I just had to get a mohawk and some face paint and the costume.
Easily done. But here's the thing about Jamela. One, she's a creature of fiction. Two, we are not the same person. And
we think.
Definitely not the same body type.
Well, the other option would be getting Barty, but we can't really do that because Colin's up in Nashville.
And Brian is in Virginia.
And probably never, ever, ever going to wear a costume.
Oh, someday I will chloroform him and he'll wake up with horns attached to his forehead. And maybe a bit more.
I'm willing to wear a Vajazzle costume and go around on all fours as Vajazzle. I'm just putting that out there. I will do it.
Oh, that would be delightful.
I will do it.
So here's the thing. We want to make a Jamela puppet. We found a connection that knows where to get a decent puppet made, and it costs $500.
That's not bad. Like a ventriloquism? No,
like a Muppet.
Like a Henson puppet.
The Muppet I could compare to best would be, say, Uncle Deadly. If you remember Uncle Deadly, the weird...
What the fuck is Uncle Deadly?
He's a weird dragon ghost Muppet from the Muppets.
The movie.
He's blue and he's got whiskers.
All I remember is Eureka's Castle.
Oh, yeah.
Uncle Deadly. Talking about.
Yeah, in the new Muppets film, he was a sidekick to Chris Cooper's character.
Mm.
Anyway, that's beside the point. Basically, a Jamela puppet and $500. And if you guys want to contribute towards that, we can make some videos with her. Jamela can finally make public appearances. She can finally go out and do her thing. So that's on the table. If you guys want to contribute to that, that's the next stretch goal. And if you reach it, not only will we make this Jamela puppet, but we'll also release another cool nerdy perk. So, what are you guys reading right now? Do you have a chance to read anything else?
I've just been reading this book, Ready Player One.
I've been reading for Christmas, wife got me Adam Hughes' covers book, and while, yes, it's a lot of pretty pictures in it, it's also kind of autobiographical because it's kind of taking you through his career as a cover artist. It's kind of cool to see, say, his thoughts on why he was taken off of Wonder Woman right before the 500th issue.
Is it a biography or like an autobiography?
In a way.
That's really cool. I didn't know that book was out. I love Adam Hughes's art.
I'll have to show it to you sometime because his cover work is so gorgeous, and it takes you through his whole process, his thought into why he did it this way, how much he hated drawing Catwoman at first and grew to really love the covers that he had done with that, his influences. So it's this weird kind of pseudo autobiography while also being a lot of pinups.
That's cool. After reading Ready Player One, I took a trip to Pittsburgh to go see Pittsburgh Batman.
Woo!
I might add, it was amazing. Absolutely incredible. And
did he throw an exploding football?
He did. You know, during the play, he didn't throw an exploding football, but he did kiss a transvestite Catwoman.
Oh, that's normal. That's normal for him.
I read the novelization of Willow. It's a novel by Waylon Drew based on a screenplay by Bob Dolman from a story by George Lucas.
What? Why would you? What's the point?
That's
why?
A lot of filters to go through.
Because one, I wanted to see what would happen when you read a novel based on a screenplay based on a story. But also, because I'm doing research for Willow Watch. And you know what?
Willow Watch.
This was not necessarily the disposable text that I thought it was going to be. Hmm. In fact, there may be a lot here that speaks from a bigger picture of Willow than we initially suspected. Maybe a 3-hour version of the film instead of a 2.5-hour version.
So you're saying there's more stuff in that book?
You see all these little dog ears in here? I made a lot of notes. And next State of the Empire, if we have enough time for a long Willow watch, I might drop some truth bombs about the world of Willow that we didn't know.
Aw, shit. You heard it here first.
What about you, Colin?
I have actually, you know, honestly, after I read Ready Player One, it was around the time when Mike had died, the 1-year anniversary. I had all these books that I guess I inherited from him. And things like, you know, Magic Boy and the Robot Elf, Quit Your Job, you know, Goodbye Chunky Rice. And they were all great. And said on my Facebook that Mike continues to recommend good books to me even after he dies. But the book that really stood out to me, he had this little volume. It's called The Stuff of Legend. And
so these have all been graphic novels, actually.
Yes, they've all been graphic novels, honestly. And this kind of creeps into comic land, but I don't care. But the Stuff of Legend is a graphic novel that is in the same style of Mouse Guard in terms of it's a square, a children's book-like format. And this book is called The Stuff of Legend. It's ongoing currently, and it's written by Mike Reicht and Brian Smith, and it's illustrated by Charles Paul Wilson III. It is an amazing book. The basically the premise, as soon as I started reading it, I was like, oh, okay. The premise is there's a boy and he has these toys whom in the very first couple panels, the boy is pulled into his closet by these black tentacles who end up being the boogeyman.
Go on.
And, yeah. And and it's like horrific. This boy, it's like the tentacles wrapping around his face. Like they're pulling him in. He's clutching his bed and he's trying to reach all of his toys and stuff, reaching out to them. And they are all like lifeless and not able to help him as he's pulled into his closet.
So hentai.
Yeah, it kind of, honestly, after the boy gets pulled into the closet, the toys come to life and they describe how they weren't able to help him and et cetera. And there is a piggy bank, a jack in a box, a teddy bear, a couple different, a soldier, a toy soldier, and they all decide to go into what's called the dark, into the closet to then find the boy and save him for the boogeyman.
I'm pretty sure you're describing the plot to Toy Story 4.
Yes. And I was like, okay, fine, Toy Story, great. This is, okay, it's just a ripoff of Toy Story. But then when they go into the closet, it goes mid-battle of the Marine being an actual Marine with a bayonet stabbing someone, and the teddy bear being this huge, ferocious bear ripping the armies of the boogeyman to shreds. Like, it is amazing. Everything, basically all of the toys turn into their real-life counterparts.
So a piggy bank is just a pig running around.
Yes, exactly. So he's lame.
Does he shit the like money?
He has money in him and stuff like that, but the thing is that he's constantly worried that he's going to break. And so the boogeyman actually comes and tries to turn the piggy bank against them because once basically the way that it's described is that the boogeyman is like, okay, well, your boy loved you and so on and so forth, but what's he going to do to you at the end when he's done with you? He breaks me.
Does Voltron go in the closet at some point?
No, no, it's nothing like that. But the art is amazing and it's ongoing. They just released an omnibus, which has the first two books, The Dark and The Jungle, together. And that's what, after I read this small first volume that came out, I got the omnibus and it is not to be missed. Like, this is the series that everyone's going to be like, holy fuck, I wish I was reading this when it was happening. I'm serious. It's that good.
That's so cool. You heard it from Colin. This is serious. You heard it. You don't want to miss this.
Yeah.
The he stuff did recommend of Legend, Ready Player One.
Yeah. The stuff of Legend is amazing, but you don't have to take my word for it.
So, Neuromancer by William Gibson. This book is a book that's been on my to-read list for a long time.
Same here.
It is massively important in the world of science fiction, and it's important to all of us here in ways that you probably don't realize.
Well, as a neuromancer, aren't they just someone who raises minds back from the dead?
Makes sense to me.
It's like necromancer, but neuro...
Okay. No. Neuro would be brain. Mancer would be magic. The necro, the coming back from the dead, comes from necro.
I see. I'm an idiot.
Yep.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay.
So,
how old is this book?
This book was made in 1984. It essentially is the ultimate text for all of cyberpunk. I'm talking about any cyberpunk you've ever read or experienced. It happens simultaneous to Blade Runner, and they are equally as relevant, but this one perhaps even more so, because this book is where the term cyberspace was coined.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, shit.
See, I didn't know that.
This book defined how people have considered and written about the internet before the internet was even something that the average, you know, the general populace understood or could contemplate. And admittedly, it's done in a way that's more similar to Ready Player One, because it's sort of a future version of the internet. This is in a dystopian future, far beyond where we, well, beyond where we are now, not too far. It's, you know, it's a place of noir and neon and grit and grime, a sprawl of technology that's gone kind of out of control. And a world that exists within the mainframes of
now,
computers.
Now, will I like it? Because I get bored really easily.
In a way, it's practically written in another language, but it's one you pick up really quickly. It happens without challenge. You dive straight into this world, and it's jarring for about a page, and then you realize what's going on.
Is this the book where they talk in weird accents?
I think you're thinking of maybe Clockwork Orange.
It's not as bad as Clockwork Orange.
Oh, and it's definitely not like Ridley Walker.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm thinking of. Everyone's like, "Hey, day by day by day."
Yeah, no, this is not Ridley Walker. This is something that's a bit more comprehensible by a long shot. And reading it, you'll be like, "Holy crap! This is where everything came from. This is Warren Ellis's Bible. This is where Transmetropolitan came from. This book has informed everything that's come after it. I'm only a quarter into this book, and by the second chapter, I realized you can tell. Oh my God." This is such a thoroughly realized vision of the future. It's incredible that he was able to put this together, because everyone who's followed him have used this as a reference point. But it's a very well thought out, very well considered thing. And it is it's the basis for a lot. This is an essential sci-fi text. It got the Hugo, the Nebula, and the Philip K. Dick Award.
Nebula is pretty big.
When I first watched High Noon, I didn't think much of it. And then when someone explained to me, well, this is the first movie that it was ever in real time, it really had impact. And I can imagine someone reading this now would go, well, what's so big about this? It's just another cyberpunk. No, this is where it all came from. This is the first.
Yeah, I mean, just hearing you describe it, I'm kind of thinking back to Casablanca when you think about that hard noir, the he's looking at you, kid, the Humphrey Bogart, the essential Humphrey Bogart that has been parodied and sent off in every noir type film that's come after it. You watch Casablanca, and it's like, man, it's a decent film.
It's a good film, but
you don't realize that was a new thing.
Shit. No, you don't watch Casablanca and go, that's a good film. You go watch Casablanca and go, holy fuck, this is an amazing movie.
I don't watch black and white films. They're boring, Colin.
God.
Boring.
So basically, if somebody made a movie of Neuromancer, they would go like, it would have really shitty marketing and nobody would see it.
Well, presumably someone must have tried to make it in the past in all these decades that have passed. But the thing is, it is
hackers.
It is a story that, hackers. Hackers is about as close as they've come. And probably hackers use this book as a reference point for their fictional flawed version of what internet hacking was like in the 1990s. Making a movie of this so far would be more or less impossible. Like, there's so much that happens within the computer that it's not Tron, you know? You'd have to come up with some kind of phony visualization of it, and it would be hard to do. The layering of the world, it's too complex. Maybe only now are we getting closer to doing it, But then we end up with game. We have games now, like Watch Dogs and so on. They are presenting alternate versions of this same sort of concept. And I don't know. There was actually a Neuromancer game on, you know, ye old computer systems of the time in the 80s. But it was very simple. It was, you know,
point was it one of those like puzzle point and click games?
Yeah.
Oh, I love those. Maybe it's available.
Maybe it was good. I don't know. Either way, maybe this would be better as a video game. Maybe movies aren't the format for it. I don't know.
Or maybe it's good as a book only.
But if you needed any more reason to get excited about it, here's what the back of the book says. Case was the sharpest data thief in the Matrix until an ex-employer crippled his nervous system. Now, a new employer has recruited him for a last chance run against an unthinkably powerful artificial intelligence. With a mirror-eyed girl street samurai riding shotgun, he's ready for the Silicon Quick, bleakly prophetic adventure that upped the ante on an entire genre of fiction.
I think it's been done.
Now, you say that Neuromancer coined the phrase of cyber...
Space.
And possibly did Neuromancer.
Did it also... coin the phrase of cyber sex, because then I'd be really interested.
I haven't quite gotten there yet, but all the sex has been IRL so far. A boring, I know. And disgusting.
That's lame.
well, but you know, that remains.
I want to stick my dick in my hard drives.
Well, I've been doing that for years. You don't need permission to do that.
Why are you sticking your dick in his hard drives?
Because why are you raping hard drives? If you're not getting permission, it's not consensual.
Because
guys.
I like warm and dry. Do you have a problem with that?
Yeah, man, that little clicky thing going back and forth on my dick, I love it.
I like when I open the disk drive and like for the CDs or the DVDs, and I put my penis in the little hole, and then I close it. I let it close on its own, and then it gets stuck, and then it does that thing where it's like stuck, and then it opens again, and then it just keeps going back and forth.
Boy.
Just imagine that. Just close your eyes and think of that.
Does the laser ever spin up?
So I just put my testicles in there and crush
them. That sounds real fun. Hex, how can we possibly make this more fun? With a song, perhaps?
Yeah, with a party. With a dead man's party. Oh. So, in Ready Player One, during Halliday's send-off video, he actually kicks it off with the song Dead Man's Party by Oingo Boingo. And that, like I mentioned, was the moment that made me just realize that this was a book for me. As a massive Oingo Boingo fanboy, it would be remiss if I did not at least showcase some Oingo Boingo. What I have is from the amazing 2007 tribute album called Drink to Bones That Turned to Dust. This is Intervision and their rendition of Dead Man's Party by Oingo Boingo.
Thanks everybody for tuning into this episode of Nerdy Show Book Club. Pick up William Gibson's Neuromancer and read along with us for the next episode. If you want to check out any of the books that we talked about in this episode, we'll have them all linked on this episode's page. And if you purchase them through our Amazon links, well, that does help out the show.
Yay!
So please do indeed. If you like what you heard, feel free to support the show. That would mean a lot to us. And thank you so much for listening to Nerdy Show Book Club. Bye, I'm Cap.
Bye, I'm Hex.
Bye, I'm Tony!
Bye, I'm Brandon.
Bye, I'm Colin.
Oingo boing loins. Oingo boing loin. Oingo boingo loingo.
Yeah, that's where Mauron came from.
Oingo... Oingo boing loing. Oingo, I can't even say it. Try
Oingo
saying, boing loings. Try saying it like five times. Oingo boing loing. Just do it.
No. Oingo boing loings. Oingo boing loings. Oingo boing loings.
It's so boing hard. You just
drowning.
Can't.
Colin, you're drowning on the words.
Try doing it, Cap. Oingo boing.
Oingo boing loings.
Faster. You gotta do like
Oingo boing loings. Oingo boing loins. 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 Oingo boing loins.
You know what? Whatever. Okay, you
got I'm better than you.
I'm better than
you.
My brain can't keep up.
Uncle Moyle loins.
Uncle Moyle? We done, gentlemen?
We're done.
Door, leave your body and soul at the door. something last night in my sleep. If the dead man parted, who could ask for more? Everybody's coming to leave your body at the door. Leave your body and soul at the door. Oh, 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 oh,
thank you for listening to the Nerdy Show Book Club.
The Nerdy Show Book Club is brought to you by a comic shop, Nerdapalooza, Play and Trade Ovido, and listeners like yourselves.
If you enjoyed what you heard, support Nerdy Show by telling a friend, picking up some merch at the Nerdy Store, or support us with your hard-earned pounds and receive exclusive perks.
For more episodes of Nerdy Show Book Club, Nerdy Show Dungeons and Doritos, videos, contests, and other nerdy programming, please visit nerdyshow.com. You can subscribe to all Nerdy Show podcasts via the iTunes Store.
Follow us on Facebook or Tumblr or on Twitter at Nerdy Show. And get social with other Nerdy Show nerds at nerdyshow.com/forums.
But don't take our word for it.
Take mine!
You beat me, Lord Axarach Delias! Boom! Headshot! Straight away I was killed by your bird!
Well, that's the way I do it, young squire!
Alright, what's next?
I flapped me!
And they lived happily ever after.
Oh, sweet baby Jesus!
Sweet baby Jesus. Sweet. Brandon, Colin,
let's just go around the table. Tony. Why not? Just Tony, okay. Demi. We'll start from you, go around, end with me.
Okay.
Colin will jump in whenever he wants.
Well, then.
No, he'll do it over me.
Then he's going to, yeah. Then he's
gonna talk Cap, over Colin, him. Hex,
no,
Tony.
No, I go before Colin.
Cap, Hex, Colin, Tony, Brandon.
No, Colin goes last.
You know what? Fine.
What?
Okay. Everyone who decided to come to this
room. This is Colin's
room,
show, so he goes last because he's least important.
But they'll remember him best because they
know. I own 25% of this company.
You own nothing.
Well, that is also true.
25% of nothing is nothing.
Okay. 3, 2, 1.